The expulsion of millions of our racial comrades provides us with a heaven-sent opportunity to exacerbate the problem of the bleeding border and to hammer constantly for its revision. For years, there has been a tremendous propaganda drive to bring the more than 10 million refugees back to their homelands, unquote. This campaign has been carried on with the full support of the Adenauer government. Bonn has nourished the hope among the Germans that through a policy of strength, unquote, the lost territories in the East can be recovered. It was precisely this view which motivated the Adenauer government to pursue a policy of diplomatic non-recognition toward all East European states. In 1952 and 1953, Dr. Adenauer and his assistants openly advocated a program of liberation. The day after his election victory in 1953, the Chancellor, in a fiery speech in Bonn, demanded the Befreiung of the territories in the East, quote, "But instead of reunification, let us talk rather of liberation, Befreiung, the liberation of our brethren in slavery in the East. That is our aim, and that we shall achieve, but only with outside help."
Okay, and before I continue, I want to just mention that you are listening to KFJC 89.7, Los Altos Hills. Continuing on, right where Dave left off. A year before that, at a press interview in Washington, the Chancellor's principal diplomatic assistant, State Secretary Walter Hallstein, defined the area to be liberated as reaching up to the Ural Mountains. At that time, the Germans dreamed of a third power bloc between America and the Soviet bloc of 550 million people, including a Slavic population of more than 200 million now living within the Soviet bloc. Let me just cut in here for a moment. Now, when they say year before that, they're talking about in 1952, okay? This is fully 7 years after World War II has ended, several years after democracy has been reinstalled in West Germany, et cetera, et cetera. The Germans are dreaming of an area up to the Soviet Ural Mountains as being now a possession of Germany and a power block of 550 million people under direct German control, including Slavs to the tune of 200 million people. The liberation concept had been freely and frequently discussed at that time in the Rheinische Merkur. One of the Chancellor's staunchest supporters, Dr. Robert Ingram, admonished the German politicians to discard the sterile concept of reunification and substitute for it a dynamic program of liberation. Quote, "The task is not reunification, but the liberation of all that has been lost," stated Dr. Ingram in a lead article. There remained little doubt that Bonn's liberation program envisioned the use of all possible means. It was Hitler's Drang nach Osten, drive to the East, all over again. Among the cities pinpointed for liberation by Dr. Ingram were Warsaw, Prague, and Vienna. The unrestrained liberation propaganda of the early 50s created such unease in diplomatic quarters at Paris and London that Dr. Adenauer was soon compelled to renounce military force as a means to recover the lost territories. Since then, the new formula in the Chancellor's statements concerning reunification and revision of the Oder-Neisse Line has become, quote, "in peace and freedom." However, apart from the Chancellor's official position, there is a very different cast to the speeches by other cabinet members before the huge refugee rallies. These revisionist overtones have not contributed toward dispelling the fears in the eastern capitals of a revengeful pan-Germanism. Let me just stress that point again, because this is a key one. We're talking about the Cold War. We're talking a shooting war in Europe that went on right up until 1952. We're talking about the basic American story has always been, well, the rotten Russians came in. They took eastern Europe. They held on to it. They put all those people into slavery. It was just crazy. It was just territorial aggression. Well, what we're looking at here is our key and prominent members of the almost completely rebuilt German hierarchy, economically rebuilt by the West, people of Nazi pedigree put into positions of power, going out to rallies of thousands and thousands of screaming Germans and talking about liberation of an area including Warsaw, Prague, and Vienna. As the author says in his more subtle way, perhaps, than I have said, I'll reread it, "These revisionist overtones have not contributed toward dispelling the fears in the eastern capitals of a revengeful pan-Germanism." going on. Being aware of the deep distrust in Warsaw and Prague, the Expelle leaders now speak quite diplomatically of the people's, quote, right to a homeland. They also claim the, quote, right to self-determination, as advocated by Woodrow Wilson in 1917. This, however, is viewed in the eastern capitals as a legalistic veil to cover up the old aggressive plans. Each year, in the spring or early summer, the Sudeten Germans and the Expelles from Silesia, East Prussia, and Pomerania come together in rallies 200,000 to 500,000 strong, organized in the best Hitler tradition. Quote, it has become customary, wrote the New York Herald Tribune correspondent Gaston Koblenz, that a minister of the Adenauer government addresses each of the larger meetings and gives assurances that the cause is never being forgotten. According to the Tribune report, Dr. Adenauer, at a meeting of 250,000 refugees from Silesia, praised the Silesians for, quote, keeping alive the memory of their homeland. At another meeting, before 500,000 Sudeten Germans at Munich, Transport Minister Hans Christian Seebohm suggested that, quote, not only the Sudeten, but also Bohemia and Moravia, which form a large part of Czechoslovakia, should be linked to Germany in the future. Cabinet Minister Theodor Oberländer once declared that the reconquest of the European East is, quote, a German and European task.
So keep in mind that the new Germany, unquote, is advocating the liberation of a territory up to the Urals, Warsaw, Vienna, Prague. As someone once said, the song was over, but the melody lingered on. Now, it's worth noting also that the inclusion of, inclusion is perhaps the wrong word, the ascension of top Nazis to positions of great post-war power is by no means something that ended in the 50s, that it continued for a long, long time. Returning again to the book The Bormann Brotherhood by former British intelligence agent and now Canadian journalist William Stevenson. Did Globke help Bormann's friends? He certainly made life easier for Schacht. That's a former Nazi finance minister, Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, who had many dealings with Western industrialists, as we've seen. Beginning again, did Globke help Bormann's friends? He certainly made life easier for Schacht. His resignation under communist pressure was window dressing to quell the anger of Western liberals. 5 years later, in September 1968, a dinner was given in his honor by President Heinrich Lübke, L-U-B-K-E, accompanied by Chancellor Kurt Kiesinger, K-I-E-S-I-N-G-E-R. The president, the chancellor, and the former state secretary thus publicly thumbed their noses at the verdict of history. In the old days, Heinrich Lübke approved the blueprints for death camps. Kiesinger supervised Nazi radio propaganda. So here we have not only the chancellor, but the president, respectively in charge of Nazi radio propaganda and approving the blueprints for the death camps.
All right, unless you think that that this other stuff ends back in the 50s and 60s and 70s, another example came up rather recently in the San Jose Mercury News for Thursday, April 23rd, 1981. I'm going to read the article, and then I'll explain it a little bit for those of you not familiar.
Actually, wasn't that in the San Jose News, the evening edition of the Mercury? Now it's called the evening edition of the Mercury. Then it used to be the San Jose News, if you want to go look that up in a library.
Indeed, for April 23rd, 1981. The headline of this short, small article is Court Closes Case in Reichstag Fire. Dateline Berlin. It's an AP Wire story. The West Berlin Supreme Court has closed the book on the 48-year-old case of a Dutch communist convicted and executed for starting the Reichstag fire in 1933 that helped propel Adolf Hitler to absolute power. The court threw out a lower court decision that had overturned the original Nazi conviction of Marnus van der Lubbe and ruled there could be no further litigation in the matter. Van der Lubbe's brother has been trying to have the conviction erased since 1955. Let me just give you that one sentence again. The court threw out a lower court decision that had overturned the original Nazi conviction of Martinus van der Lubbe and ruled there could be no further litigation in the matter, sort of like sealing the transcripts for 100 years type of a thing.
Recall that the Reichstag fire was a provocation set up by the Nazis in order to achieve the total dictatorial powers that they desired. And in order to achieve those powers, they blamed the Reichstag fire on the communists, and they produced a former member of the Dutch Communist Party, the aforementioned Martinus van der Lubbe, who was legally blind and legally insane, and they had him wandering around in the general vicinity of the burning Reichstag with matches and gasoline. Keep in mind that the Reichstag adjoined a tunnel which was connected to Reichsmarschall Hermann Göring, later head of the Luftwaffe's house, which just happened to be next door to the Reichstag fire. He appears on the steps of the Reichstag announcing, "Look, the commies burned down..." The Reichstag was the German parliamentary building, by the way. "The commies burned down the Reichstag building, and they took poor Martinus van der Lubbe, legally blind and legally insane, blamed it on him, then chopped his head off," and that was the start of the Nazi dictatorship. Now recall that the West German Supreme Court has now formally instituted the Reichstag verdict as unchallengeable West German law.
Another unchallengeable verdict that it brings to mind, and the connection I'm going to make very briefly before we take a break, is that during the time after the Kennedy assassination Warren Commission report came out, as we talked about during our Guns of November special, and of course there were numerous critics of the Warren Commission report, one of the ways in which the CIA in an internal security memo suggested that people defuse criticism of the Warren Commission report was to link criticism of the Warren Commission report as being similar to the attempt to blame the Reichstag fire on the Nazis. In other words, the CIA took the Nazi point of view to defend the Warren Commission report. So what goes around comes around. This is Nip Tuck. For myself and Dave Emery, we'll be back in just about 5 minutes with the third section of Looking Back from 1984, A Hidden History of the Cold War. You are listening to Radio Free America on KFJC. Well, good evening again. Welcome back. This is Nip Tuck going into the third section. And I realize our time is a little staggered here, but this stuff, sometimes the explanations take longer than we expect them to, or shorter than we expect them to, or whatever the case may be. But it is all going to come out even to 4 hours in the end. Don't you worry. We've got that all figured out in advance. I am here in the studio, of course, with Dave Emery. And Dave and myself are continuing with the second half of a broadcast we began last month called Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War. And at this point in our broadcast, we are moving back to American soil because, of course, when you talk about the Cold War, you were talking to a large extent about the United States and Russia. And in fact, what we're talking about here is how some of the other events that we have talked about earlier in the broadcast tonight and in last month's broadcast had a very serious involvement and a very serious effect on the formation of the Cold War mentality in the United States and the actual infrastructure of the repression of the political left and moderate leftist center of the United States. Now, mind you, we're not talking just about the commies being hauled off the streets. We're talking about all public opinion anywhere to the left of John Foster Dulles, Richard Nixon et al. Being systematically silenced is in fact what we're talking about. And as we mentioned earlier, a very large part of this had to do with the fact that the entire focus on Soviet-American relations, the front line of Soviet-American relations, was in fact the entire unrehabilitated Nazi intelligence services and an unrehabilitated Nazi Germany, government of West Germany, rather, full of unrehabilitated Nazis. And in fact, that was our funnel for most of the information coming into the United States and then being handed over to the American people.
Right, and you keep that in mind, is that the Nazi intelligence apparatus provided us with all of our intelligence on Russia. The importance of that cannot be exaggerated too much, as you keep in mind a Hitler's statement about lying, okay? Now, one of the things that is one of the significant events in the Cold War and in the fierce anti-communism and one might say repressive attitude to even beyond anti-communism that has characterized much of the Cold War was the very famous perjury trial of Alger Hiss, a State Department official accused by a man named Whitaker Chambers of having been a communist spy in the State Department before and during World War II. Now, Alger Hiss was the president of the Carnegie Endowment for Peace, and in the first part of Looking Back from 1984, The Hidden History of the Cold War, we encountered Alger Hiss again. Now, one of the things that we looked at in the first part of that broadcast was the very significant aid given to the Nazi Germany by all of the world's industrialists, specifically American industrialists. And one of the things that we looked at was how the Curtiss Wright Aircraft Corporation betrayed the secret of dive bombing to the Axis, which then provided the basis for their infamous Stuka dive by the German Stuka dive bombers. Dive bombing had previously been a very closely guarded U.S. Navy secret, okay? And the president of Curtiss Wright Corporation, a man named Henry Allard, was one of a number of American industrialists who worked with Nazi Germany who were investigated by a special Senate committee called the Nye Committee. Now, the special counsel to the Nye Committee was none other than Alger Hiss, and in a lecture tour, he became really quite well known for his work with the Nye Committee and became something of a celebrity and one of the leading figures in exposing the Nazi-American industrial connections.
Now, you will remember also that I mentioned when Dave was reading about a Congressman Jerry Voorhees from California, from Van Nuys, I think, as a matter of fact, that Jerry Voorhees, as a matter of fact, was a man who was very much involved in the study and the refutation of American involvement in various German trusts and in the bizarre bedfellows that came about in the connection between Nazi industrialists and American industrialists. Well, Jerry Voorhees, of course, was defeated in a bitter and, in fact, very dirty campaign where, among other things, Richard Nixon falsely accused Jerry Voorhees of being the choice of local communists, brandished papers that didn't say what he claimed they said, et cetera, et cetera, defeated Jerry Voorhees. Well, Alger Hiss, of course, was another prominent character in the struggle to separate the America from the Nazi money machine and Nazi participation in world business markets and the cooperation of American industrialists with Nazi interests. And son of a gun, if Alger Hiss in the famous Hiss trial, after allegations by Whitaker Chambers, who we'll discuss in a moment, was not in fact pinioned by then up-and-coming Richard Nixon, later to become Vice President of the United States under Eisenhower. So once again, Richard Nixon has had made his reputation on the back of somebody who, if left around, might have been able to do further work toward peeling off some of the secrecy covering American participation in Nazi industrial activity. Now, Whitaker Chambers, the man who made the accusations against Alger Hiss, it's a long and very complicated story. Unfortunately, we don't have time enough tonight to go into the entire matter. Volumes have been written about it. It's still in dispute to this day. However, some of the interesting things, we did talk briefly last week. We read a letter written recently. Whitaker Chambers was posthumously awarded the Medal of Freedom, the highest civilian honor that the American government can give, by Ronald Reagan, President Reagan. A letter was written to the New York Times by Dorothy Sterling, a former Time magazine staffer who had worked with Whitaker Chambers in the 40s and early 50s. And Dorothy Sterling said, in regarding the posthumous Medal of Freedom awarded to Whitaker Chambers, the crux of her letter was that America should think twice before giving somebody like Whitaker Chambers this medal, and that she couldn't really quite figure out Ronald Reagan's reasons for doing so, because of the fact that Whitaker Chambers was such a known liar and prevaricator and right-wing ideologue that, in fact, he was throwing out stories submitted to the Time, to Time magazine, from their outside reporters, people like Theodore White and John Hersey, giants in their field. Any story that was the least bit favorable or open-minded towards communist or Russian-friendly governments, or governments that were in any way outside the U.S. straight, at that time, right-wing line. How Whitaker Chambers would literally rewrite articles to change the entire factual basis of them to make the communists look bad. He would throw them out. He destroyed so many articles that John Hersey, later to be a Pulitzer Prize winner, sent from Russia, that Hersey gave up covering political matters altogether and just covered concert openings and things of that nature. And the letter from Dorothy Sterling also mentioned that Whitaker Chambers was involved in so many inconsistencies in his testimony and so many out and out lies that one of the senators involved in the hearing said, "Well, Mr. Chambers, it seems that falsehood or that lying comes easy to you." And Whitaker Chambers admitted, "Yes, it certainly did."
It was actually Lloyd Paul Stryker who was during the grand jury hearings who was actually the first of his attorneys.
That's right. That's right.
Now, one of the books that we dealt with in the first part of Looking Back from 1984, Hidden History of the Cold War, was a book called Friendship and Fratricide. Friendship and Fratricide was authored by an American psychiatrist named Meyer Zeligs, last name Z-E-L-I-G-S, who I believe used to live right down in Monterey. The book was published in hardcover, copyrighted 1967, published by the Viking Press. And in Friendship and Fratricide, Meyer Zeligs discusses the beginning of Chambers' campaign, I guess you might say, against Alger Hiss. Now, he first made the charges against Hiss not in 1948, but in 1938. Excuse me, before World War II, and a good 7 years before, or 6 years before the time period that Dorothy Sterling was writing about in that letter, during which Chambers deep-sixed all of the information concerning the democratic provisional governments that had been set up in Europe by the various anti-fascist partisan movements, which we covered in the first broadcast as well. Now, of Chambers powwowing with a State Department official named Adolph A. Burley, B-E-R-L-E, and also his powwowing with the FBI. Again, this is 1938, 10 years before the charges against Hiss first became public. Meyer Zeligs writes as follows. Chambers had first made the charge secretly 10 years before, after leaving the Communist Party, in a privately arranged conversation with Assistant Secretary of State Adolph A. Burley, Jr. Remember the name Adolph Burley? We're going to come back to him later. Hiss knew nothing of Chambers' initial charges or of any investigation of him at that time by the FBI, as no action was taken by them. However, subsequent interrogations by the FBI of Hiss and Chambers made it likely that Chambers' charge might be revived at any moment. And to be sure, in August of 1948, under the auspices of the House Committee on Un-American Activities, which was pursuing alleged communist infiltration of government, Chambers again named Hiss, among others, as having been a communist during the 1930s. Now, keep in mind that the FBI was very active in the Hiss case against Alger Hiss on behalf of Whitaker Chambers, because we're going to talk about J. Edgar Hoover. Keep in mind the name Adolf A. Burley. Keep in mind Chambers' activities as a right-wing editor of Time magazine in suppressing information which was detrimental to his right-wing viewpoint. Keep in mind also the following sentence. And unfortunately, Meyer-Zelig does not go into this in any greater length, but keep in mind the following sentence. About Whitaker Chambers, Zelig writes, "At Columbia, he made a name for himself as a literary figure and later held jobs in the Daily Worker and for a short time on the New Masses. For much of his life, he supported himself by doing freelance translations. It was thought by some that at one time he had been a German spy." No documentation is presented here by Zelig, although I'm told he actually did have some, but he felt it was irrelevant to his psychoanalytic viewpoint. Keep in mind, he was a psychiatrist, and he was attempting to psychoanalyze the main participants here. But keep in mind, the sentence, it was thought by some that in one time he had been a German spy.
Okay, reading also from Friendship and Fratricide, Zelig here relates an anecdote handed to him by A.J. Liebling, and it says, "In the early 30s, a reformed left-wing novelist named Edwin Seaver, a New Masses literary light, met Chambers at some leftist powwow, and Chambers invited him to dinner at Chambers' Digs in Newark. Seaver was so broke that Chambers had to provide him with round-trip fare on the Hudson Tubes, $2. When Seaver arrived at Chambers' squalid apartment, he saw a large, almost life-size portrait of Hitler hanging in the most prominent spot. Seaver expressed astonishment, and Chambers said, 'Oh, that's just to throw them off the track.' Who the hell them was, he didn't specify. He was always, in his own fantasy, being pursued. After a scanty meal and some talk, Seaver started to go, and Chambers asked him to take some letters with him and leave them at some address in the village to save postage. Seaver said he delivered the letters and so, unwittingly, became a courier himself."
Okay. Now, according to Whitaker Chambers, it was he who arranged for Alger Hiss to become a communist spy. And according to Chambers, his control was the man who set up the Hiss connection within the State Department. That was a man, according to Chambers, a Soviet intelligence agent named Bykov, last name B-Y-K-O-V. Now, pay attention to the account here that Chambers gives, and try and note all of the grotesque indiscrepancies in the many different versions of the alleged Hiss-Chambers-Bykov story here, Hiss-Chambers-Bykov meeting. In a footnote, in Friendship and Fratricide, Zelig writes as follows. "It was Bykov, Chambers' story goes, who ordered him in 1936, remember that date, to give Hiss an oriental rug as a gift from the Soviet people. And shortly thereafter, January 1937, says Chambers, the way having been paved and on Bykov's orders, he arranged a meeting with Hiss. I told Mr. Hiss that Peter wished to meet him, Peter, Colonel Bykov, that is, that the meeting was to take place in New York. Accordingly, Hiss met Chambers at, quote, a cafeteria on Chambers Street, unquote, and then Chambers, quote, took Mr. Hiss in Brooklyn to the Prospect Theater, a movie house on 9th Street. We went into the movie house and sat down on a bench on the mezzanine. Colonel Bykov came out of the audience, and I introduced him to Alger Hiss. Then, Chambers continues, the three walked away from the movie and went, either by taxi or subway or both, to a Chinese restaurant in Manhattan. The substance of the conversation was that the Soviet Union was acutely endangered by the rise of the fascist powers, that it needed help, and that Mr. Hiss could greatly help if he would procure documents from the State Department. Mr. Hiss agreed. During the conversation, Bykov spoke only German, and Chambers acted as interpreter. At one point, the conversation turned to Hiss's brother, Donald. Colonel Bykov asked Mr. Hiss if Mr. Hiss's brother, Donald Hiss, could also procure documents, and Mr. Hiss replied that he did not know whether or not his brother was yet sufficiently developed for such work. Colonel Bykoff said perhaps he can persuade him, unquote. Chambers remembers this well, quote, because Colonel Bykoff spoke German with a very thick accent, and the German word for persuade is überreden, unquote. And Colonel Bykoff mangled the words so badly that I had difficulty in understanding him, and I saw Mr. Hiss look at me curiously, wondering why I could not understand the colonel better. So keep in mind, Chambers is supposedly relaying all of this conversation in German, okay? In the Baltimore deposition, Chambers told the Bykoff story with different dates. In August or early fall of 1937, I arranged a meeting between Alger Hiss and Colonel Bykoff. Another item in the Bykoff story is demonstrably false. Donald Hiss did not enter the State Department until February 1, 1938. Keep in mind, that's after Bykoff supposedly tried to recruit Donald Hiss. A minor discrepancy here, I think you'd have to agree. Apart from these, there are even more serious inconsistencies in Chambers' story about his, quote, superior, unquote, Bykoff. In an FBI report of an interview with Chambers on June 26, 1945, the FBI investigator wrote that Chambers had told him, quote, other people whom he met while in the company of Peter included an individual who was later identified to him as Boris Bykoff by Krivitsky. He recalled that during 1936 he met Peter one time in a theater which he could not recall. Keep in mind that supposedly Boris Bykoff was identified for Chambers by Krivitsky, very different than the fact that Bykoff was Chambers' control, in essence. He recalled that during 1936 he met Peter one time in a theater which he could not recall. Peter was accompanied by a man 5 feet 7 inches tall, red hair, slightly baldy, Jewish, very sloppy appearance, who spoke very little English and poor German, and was apparently 36 to 37 years old in 1937. Chambers explained that Peter introduced him to this man, giving him some first name he could not recall. Chambers sensed, unquote, that this man was connected with OGPU, Russian intelligence, because he believed he had been introduced to the man so that the latter could size up Chambers. It was his impression that these men may have been secret agents of Peter, who were instructed to check up on Chambers' activities and his personal life. In the FBI interview, it was Peter who was in a theater with Bykoff, and there introduced Bykoff to Chambers. In his later version, it was Chambers who took Hiss to a theater and then introduced him to Bykoff. And there is further evidence in Wadley's testimony, that being Julian Wadley, a State Department crony of Hiss's who admitted to being a spy for the Russians. And there is further evidence in Wadley's testimony that Chambers' story about Bykoff and Hiss is a product of Chambers' imagination. Wadley testified that Chambers introduced him to Sasha, unquote, and intimated that Sasha was Chambers' quote, boss in the apparatus, unquote. Chambers identified Sasha with Bykoff, as he had to do if he was to avoid attributing two heads to the same apparatus. The boss whom Wadley met had only one arm. Bykoff had two. So one of the things about Chambers' story is that there's many stories is that it's really very difficult to keep track of all the many different inconsistencies that he told. There was the House Un-American Activities Committee hearing. There was the grand jury hearing. There was a libel case that Hiss filed against Chambers. There were two trials, the first one ending in a hung jury and an appeal case. And, you can't tell a player without a scorecard. I personally can never keep Chambers' lies sort of straight without the many different versions, let's say, that he told without having it all in front of you. But notice the many inconsistencies here that supposedly Bykoff, Chambers' control, was trying to recruit Donald Hiss, who wasn't even in the State Department at the time that he was supposedly trying to recruit him. Notice that the number of arms that Bykoff had appears to be in dispute. Notice that the whole conversation supposedly took place in German with Chambers as the interpreter. And notice the many discrepancies on just how this meeting took place. And again, this is just one of the many examples of how Whitaker Chambers dissembled in the course of his accusations against Alger Hiss.
Okay, now, we're going to move on to examine another piece of the puzzle, I suppose, although this does, as Dave pointed out earlier, impinges to an extent on the Hiss case in that one of the largest factors in the Hiss case was the continuing FBI investigation of Alger Hiss. From the time of Whitaker Chambers' first accusations back in that much quoted year of 1938, when a lot of these things were supposedly going on. One of the things to look at, of course, is among other things, is what is the factual history of the FBI. Well, obviously, we don't have time for all of that tonight. We do have some rather interesting information that a lot of people out there are probably not familiar with on the FBI, on Hoover, and more pertinently on the FBI's participation in an organization that many of you have heard of and many of you do not know probably too much about, which is Interpol.
Now, Interpol is actually a private corporation. It is a sort of an international police organization which coordinates the federal police of more than 100 different nations. It is actually, though, begun in 1923. It's actually a private corporation, okay? Now, its name was originally the ICPC, standing for the International Criminal Police Commission. It's now known as the International Criminal Police Organization. Okay, so that keep in mind, this is a private corporation linking the federal police of 100 different countries. Now, due to an internal jurisdictional dispute, Interpol's president was established by consensus among the membership to be the president of the Austrian Federal Police. Now, in 1938, in March of 1938, Adolf Hitler invaded and annexed Austria. Okay, that's specifically the Anschluss, as it was called, which was Hitler's annexation of Austria, took place on March 12, 1938. Okay, now, the United States at this point was being considered for inclusion in Interpol, and of course it was J. Edgar Hoover's FBI, which would have been, and in fact was, the organization to have been included in Interpol. Now, the United States became a member of Interpol in June of 1938. Now, as soon as Adolf Hitler annexed Austria, he fired and, in fact, imprisoned the head of the Austrian Federal Police, a man named Stubel, S-T-U-B-L, and replaced him with a German Nazi named Otto Steinhausel. His name was S-T-E-I-N-H-A-U-S-L. Now, prior to Hitler's annexation of Austria, the Nazi Party was illegal in Austria, okay? So keep in mind that Hitler annexes Austria on March 12, 1938. June 10, 1938, the United States becomes a member of Interpol. As soon as Hitler annexes Austria, he fires and imprisons the head of the Austrian Federal Police, Stubel, replaces him with a previously imprisoned Nazi named Otto Steinhausel, who then assumes, because he becomes head of the Austrian Federal Police, and recall that by prior agreement among the members of Interpol, due to an internal dispute, the head of the Austrian Federal Police was president of Interpol. Otto Steinhausel, the Nazi, was president of Interpol at the moment at which J. Edgar Hoover's FBI became a member of Interpol. Now, this is taking place in 1938, which is also the very same year in which Whitaker Chambers is first powwowing with Undersecretary of State Adolph Burley Jr., and also in which the FBI, the same FBI headed up by J. Edgar Hoover, is beginning its investigation of Alger Hiss. So, March of 38, Hitler annexes Austria, makes the president of Interpol Nazi Otto Steinhausel. June of 38, Interpol, the United States, and J. Edgar Hoover's FBI joins Interpol. And it's worth noting, as we're going to see a little later, talking about the history of Interpol, that Steinhausel, who was in poor health from his internment before Austria became Nazi, Steinhausel died about a year after assuming the head of the Austrian Federal Police and the presidentship of the presidency of Interpol. He was replaced by none other than Reinhard Heydrich, the head of the Sicherheitsdienst, the SS intelligence service, and again, known appropriately enough as the Hangman.
Okay, this is from a book entitled The Interpol Connection. It's written by Vaughn Young and Trevor Meldal Johnson. That last name is Meldal-Johnson. It's copyright 1979 by the Dial Press. It says as follows, in spite of Hoover's activities, this of course is J. Edgar Hoover, in spite of Hoover's activities against pro-Nazi sympathizers at home, documents obtained under the Freedom of Information Act reveal that the FBI actively cooperated with the Nazi Interpol for a year and a half after Europe had fallen to Hitler. and that Hoover consistently maintained the fiction that the ICPC was an, quote, independent organization. On March 28, 1939, the State Department telephoned the FBI to ask if Germany had taken over control of Interpol, quote, or whether the FBI had any information along that line, whatever. Hoover replied that, quote, the meeting in Berlin is merely being held in Germany this year. The organization is an independent entity which holds its meetings in different countries at different times, unquote. We'll get back to that. Of course, this was after Germany had taken over Austria and Interpol, imprisoning some of its officials and installing its own puppet Steinhausel as president, after releasing him from jail in Vienna. During this time, Hoover's relations with Interpol officials were extremely cordial. For example, W. Fleischer, a Third Reich criminal police commissioner and a Hoover admirer, wrote to the FBI chief on June 26, 1939, thanking him for the FBI's annual report and proudly informing Hoover that the Reich's fingerprint division had 772,371 fingerprint records. He enclosed a photograph of Berlin's new police laboratory and concluded by saying, quote, may I ask you a personal favor? I should be deeply grateful to you if you could send me a photograph of yourself with a little dedication. Hoover sent him an autographed photograph. This was after the fall of Czechoslovakia. Let me go back and touch on one thing real quickly. That is, again, now, the State Department, which at this time was the Roosevelt government State Department, the New Deal Roosevelt government hated by the right wing in this country.
Of which Alger Hiss was a member.
And to become a leading proponent of decontaminating American business and their connections with the Nazis later on. This Roosevelt State Department contacted the FBI, asked them if Interpol had been taken over by the Nazis, which in fact it obviously had, and Hoover told them no, and in fact flat out lied to them, and at the same time was carrying on friendly